Our last word in business is soda wars. The rivalry between Coke and Pepsi has taken a new form. It's now about reducing carbon emissions and eliminating petroleum in their bottles. Yesterday, Pepsi announced it had a new bottle made entirely of plant materials, including switchgrass, pine bark, and corn husks. Pepsi points out that Coke's environmentally friendly bottle, which has been out for a couple of years now, has only 30% plant-based materials. After Pepsi's announcement yesterday, Coke shot back, saying it's working toward a 100% plant-based bottle. Environmentalists are enjoying the soda maker's arms race. A scientist with one green group calls this the beginning of the end of petroleum-based plastic. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
The Detroit Symphony Orchestra is one of America's best, but for 5 months it's been silenced by a musician strike. And after formal negotiations broke down, the fight continued on Facebook. Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra has this report.
Before the strike, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra Facebook fan page used to look like a typical fan page. Posts about visiting conductors, upcoming concerts, the orchestra's Tiny Tot series. But once the strike began, it essentially hijacked the fan page. While the orchestra may have wanted to talk about Tiny Tot's concerts, the audience wanted to talk about the orchestra's problems. The musicians used their own Facebook fan page to post updates there. Management started doing the same thing on the official fan page. Here's the orchestra's executive director, Ann Parsons, talking about the vibe on the Facebook page.
There's a lot of engagement, I can tell you that. There's a lot of chatter, a lot of opinions being expressed. So I would say it's a pretty active place to be.
Active is one way to describe it. Like many discussions online, some of these became heated, prompting DSO conductor Leonard Slatkin to call the fan page vitriolic at one point. One particularly incendiary post was back in January, when management called into question how many people in a fan group called Save Our Symphony actually contributed money to the orchestra. 169 people left comments. They were overwhelmingly negative. Here's a small sample.
I'm shocked, saddened, and disgusted by this post. If you're trying to prove how unprofessional you can be, bravo.
In the time it took to type this posting, a phone call could have been made to a potential donor.
I've been on the fence during this whole strike thing, trying to learn the whole story. And this post finally teeters me over to the side of the musicians.
In my mind, I felt that that was not effective at all. You had fans that you were insulting.
That's Cornelia Pukshiva. She's a longtime fan and patron of the orchestra, and she reads and posts comments to the DSO fan page almost every day.
I'm not sure anybody's changing their mind based on what they read, but it is an outlet for people to raise these points.
Her biggest complaint is that management doesn't interact enough with the people who post to the Facebook fan page.
It seems that the strategy should be to engage them and not just host a discussion board. There are a lot of angry people on there, and I think that they need to do something to build that bridge with the musicians and get their fans back. I'm sure there's a lesson to be learned from it, and you can be sure that, you know, other arts and culture organizations are paying close attention right now.
Christy Nordhelm is a marketing professor at the University of Michigan, where she teaches a class about social media. She says if there is a lesson to be learned from the orchestra Facebook page, it's that social media is an open and public discussion. And she says there are some things you can't discuss that openly, at least not constructively.
You cannot negotiate a labor agreement on the social media. That doesn't work. And it's just a poor execution and a poor use of social media as a tool.
Labor negotiations are intense. Emotions are running high. And Nordhelm says by trying to open up that discussion to the public, you just end up alienating your audience. She says the orchestra's image will be hurt by the fight on Facebook. The question is, for how long? Her advice for the DSO?
First, shut up. You know, just stop. And then second, wait quietly until people forget.
She says lucky for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, the public has a short attention span. The question is, will the musicians? For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Guerra.
Public universities want to enroll more international students. Foreigners bring diversity and revenue with their full fare tuition fees. The problem is state universities don't have the budgets to recruit on their own. New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Cheryl Rich Kern explains that some colleges are hiring for-profit companies to do recruiting for them.
It's midday at the University of Massachusetts campus in Lowell, an urban school in the heart of a historic mill town close to Boston. 9 out of 10 of the 14,000 undergrads here come from within the state. The university is on a mission to lure more students from beyond Massachusetts, and especially beyond U.S. borders.
I'm Jasmith Lopez from Bombay, India. I'm 18 years old.
So what we're going to do is not reassemble.
Lopez takes a calculus class thousands of miles from home.
If you have a higher degree from United States, it's a great achievement.
That's what Lopez told his guidance counselor in India. And that's when he heard about Navitas and its classes that help foreign students transition to an American university. Ahmed Abdullal is the provost at UMass Lowell. He says students pay Navitas the full out-of-state tuition. The university provides classroom facilities.
And then they compensate us for those services.
Navitas passes along about 30% of tuition to UMass, but when students matriculate, they pay full tuition to the university. Barmak Nasirian is with the American Association of Collegiate Registrars. Nasirian says the use of commissioned agents raises questions about the practices that get one student in over another.
Some of these arrangements with the for-profit don't just stop with the presentation of a pre-screened applicant for the university to pick from, but in some instances, there are actual academic functions being performed. You have to wonder which is the dog and which is the tail.
Again, Provost Abdullal.
I think there is zero risk. Why do I say that? Because we are in charge.
The UMass Lowell provost says universities have to think globally to survive, but they need resources.
The contribution of the state to the UMass Lowell budget has steadily decreased. At this point of time, it is 21% of our budget. It used to be 70-80%.
The University of New Hampshire is about an hour north of Lowell. Its pastoral campus couldn't be more different, but the budgetary constraints are similar. UNH is launching its own Navitas program in the spring. Lisa McFarlane is the university provost. McFarlane says that with the number of U.S. secondary students on the decline, the timing is right.
It's very expensive to recruit students internationally from your own home campus. There is no way that we would ever have the money, the time, the expertise to be able to identify qualified students in all of those areas of the world.
A decade ago, admissions counselors would have scoffed at hiring recruiters whose primary motive was profit. But that was before the recession and dramatic cuts in state and federal funding. For NPR News, this is Cheryl Rich Kern.
For many sports fans, boxing has fallen off the radar screen, but a new international boxing league with teams and playoffs is trying to make the sport relevant again. The World Series of Boxing wraps up its first regular season this week. There are 12 teams competing in cities from Beijing to Paris to Los Angeles, and they feature some of the world's best amateur boxers. But they're paid and treated like professionals with the promise that they can still fight in the Olympics. NPR's Tom Goldman recently spent some time with the league's L.A. Matadors. He filed this report.
It's Hollywood, so there will be lights, camera, the Versus Network is here, and plenty of action. But before this World Series of Boxing match between the L.A. Matadors and Memphis Force, A quiet ritual, a coach taping a fighter's hands.
Talk to me, okay? If it's too tight, too loose,
okay.
You let me know, you talk to me.
All right. LA head coach Manny Robles does most of the talking as he wraps gauze and adhesive tape. Robles fixes his eyes on 18-year-old Joseph Diaz, who's about to fight his first match at home.
This is LA.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what pressure is till you come to LA.
Nope.
This is your backyard.
That's right.
You ain't gonna let no man come and disrespect you in your own backyard, right?
I don't know.
Now taped and wearing bright red boxing gloves, Diaz throws a flurry of warm-up punches into a coach's padded mitts. He and his four teammates, who'll also fight tonight, are amateurs, or were, before they signed with the World Series of Boxing. Now, they're really semi-pros. They'll get paid tonight. Winners get $5,000, losers $1,000. And they'll fight at the club Avalon Hollywood, in front of a packed house dotted with L.A. celebrities like Lakers owner Dr. Jerry Buss and actress comedian Jenny McCarthy. Before the first fight, referee Eddie Hernandez gathers the matadors dressed in their matador black trunks with gold trim.
All right, you guys are boxing at a professional venue here. I expect you to act professional. I want you to protect yourself at all times and obey my commands at all times. All right? Good luck, guys.
Good luck. Matador heavyweight David Emosri can't believe his. Sorry, forgot the boxing nickname.
David the Dreamcatcher Emosri, Long Beach, California.
David the Dreamcatcher was one of the first amateurs drafted by the Matadors. All World Series of Boxing fighters are hand-picked. Emosri's story is a classic boxer's hard luck tale. His mom died when he was 12. He drifted, found boxing, found trouble as well. He went to jail after he got into it with a cop who caught Emosri on a commuter train without a ticket. Now, as a Matador, Emosri has made about $50,000 in his first season.
Coming from not being able to have $1.50 on the train to got my own car, and you know, I'm good now. This is like not a big deal. Like, pay my bills, just getting, you know, getting my life in order.
And doing it with a new family of fighters. In the pro game, it's often a mercenary and lonely life. Not so in the WSB.
We do everything together. We run in the morning, we train together, we eat together.
Coach Manny Robles has taken on the decidedly unfearsome boxing nickname, Manny the Nanny.
I don't stay with them, but I feel like I do because they're always calling me. Hey, coach, I need this. Hey, coach, I need that.
Most needs are met. With a 3-year contract, room and board, health benefits, WSB fighters have the kind of stability that's rare in the sport. And a rare opportunity for these guys, the International Boxing Federation, which created the WSB, is letting these semi-pros retain their amateur status and compete in the Olympics. Chris Sweet Pea Pearson is a 20-year-old middleweight for the Matadors.
That was the major thing. Like, if I could get the pro experience and still be able to, you know, make the Olympic team and get a gold medal, you know, that was like a win-win for me.
Whether or not they take the Olympics by storm, the Matadors certainly are making their mark in the new league. They won the match I saw. Then Monday night this week, the Matadors clinched a spot in the first WSB playoffs. News you didn't find in the LA Times. California's biggest newspaper hasn't covered the team. Filling the Avalon Hollywood is one thing. Reaching a mass audience obviously remains a challenge. But the WSB is confident it'll grab more attention in year two. The Matadors and 11 other WSB teams will keep fighting, alone in the ring, together, everywhere else.
1, 2, 3, family!
1, 2, 3, family!
Woo! Familia! Tom Goldman, NPR News.